With CarGurus Discover, you can skip the filters and describe what you're looking for in your own words. Simply type what you want, and CarGurus Discover instantly surfaces real listings that match your exact needs. It's no wonder CarGurus is the number one most visited car shopping site, according to SimilarWeb's estimated traffic data. Buy or sell your next car today with CarGurus at CarGurus.com. Go to CarGurus.com to make sure your big deal is the best deal. That's CarGurus.com. CarGurus.com. With CarGurus Discover, you can skip the filters and describe what you're looking for in your own words. Simply type what you want, and CarGurus Discover instantly surfaces real listings that match your exact needs. It's no wonder CarGurus is the number one most visited car shopping site, according to SimilarWeb's estimated traffic data. Buy or sell your next car today with CarGurus at CarGurus.com. Go to CarGurus.com to make sure your big deal is the best deal. That's CarGurus.com. CarGurus.com. With CarGurus Discover, you can skip the filters and describe what you're looking for in your own words. Simply type what you want, and CarGurus Discover instantly surfaces real listings that match your exact needs. It's no wonder CarGurus is the number one most visited car shopping site, according to SimilarWeb's estimated traffic data. Buy or sell your next car today with CarGurus at CarGurus.com. Go to CarGurus.com to make sure your big deal is the best deal. That's CarGurus.com. CarGurus.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
And Kate.
Welcome back to Med Crimes.
Do-do-do-do.
I just had to serenade you all.
I mean, you know, we're just full of surprises, the two of us.
You never full know when surprises. I'm going to break out in song.
You never, that's a true story. We never know when Devin's going to break out in song.
It could really happen at any point in individual time.
So true. Everybody,
I feel out. Like, you know, I feel like I haven't done this with you in so long. We yep. knew that our schedules were going to be a little wonky, so we stacked.
Mm-hmm. We sure
but
did.
But now it's like, I miss my pod lab.
I know. You got to get in here and you got to sit in your cloud and you got to try out your new electrical blanket because my dog chewed up the other one. You're welcome. Did I forget to tell you that? Yeah, I bought you a new one.
Which dog? Which one? Sally or Stella?
The chewer. Sally, my golden retriever who cannot keep anything out of her mouth. Goodness. She is a slut for an electric blanket, that one. She will just gnaw on that thing until the Y is. I don't know what it is about just electrical blankets. She will not chew other blankets. But if you leave her with an electric blanket...
So I know we had our thing for comfort out there. So Med Crimes, type in Med Crimes, correct? On comfort, C-O-M-F-R-T, for 15% off your order. Because, friends, I have received the Dreamer blanket for my birthday a few weeks
so
ago.
So comfy.
That thing is the most luxurious thing I have ever put on my body. It is amazing.
I want that blanket.
I have the XL size, the XL Dreamer, which is like a queen size. So for a throw, that's really, really big. And it's like, it's mildly weighted, but it's not a weighted blanket. But the fabric, if you're going to get 15% off anything on that website, I suggest the comfort blanket because the Dreamer blanket, it absolutely to die for.
I actually the other day just got the Jersey joggers in like that charcoal gray color. And they are the most comfortable frickin' pants I have ever worn on the lower half of my body. So my legs, my butt cheeks, they were singing songs because they were they were very comfy and they were very soft. So yeah, comfrt.com/medcrimes. Go check it out. You get 15% off. Yep.
You're going to do it. I'm going to quote one of my most favorite influencers. If you don't do it, you're dumb. You guys got to follow Gia Pendercast. She is just...
Yes. She is funny.
Oh, my God. When she's telling us deals that we all got to get, which who has the time to spend all this money that
you're
she spends,
dumb.
Which she shops a lot, but she goes, you're dumb.
Oh, that's funny. Oh, goodness.
Devinism today.
We so do. And before we get into that, we have a couple of Patreons to announce.
Yay.
We have April Hunley. Hey, April.
Hey, April.
It's almost April.
I was just going to say it's almost your month.
And Anthony Fusco. Hi, Anthony.
Anthony Fusco.
Yes. So welcome, you guys. We are so, so, so happy to have you as part of our family. And we have a creature. You guys are Jaegers. And if you have seen the movie Pacific Rim, they're from Pacific Rim. So the Jaegers are these like sweet giant robots that fight all the gross monsters that come freaking crawling out of the sea. They're called kaiju or something. I saw this movie years ago. And the Jaegers are like the military robots that just like fight them and defeat them so that they can't like get on land and wreak havoc. And that's what you guys are. You're the protectors. So thank you for that.
Wow. Yep. Look at you.
Yep.
So I'm also going to put in another plug. I am full of plugs. Well, since you mentioned a movie, I was told today about a show that's kind of sitcom-y. And it's on Netflix, and it's very pertinent to this podcast in a way that it's medical. So for anyone that's in the long-term care field, like Kate and myself, I am told that Man on the Inside is one of the most hysterical shows ever.
Man on the Inside? I've never heard of it.
So I just was told about it today. Netflix, the episodes are only like 30 minutes long, so it's like quick, easy. But basically, this guy has to go undercover as like a resident inside an assisted living. And so anything that they talk about in the episode, like, you know, they're doing resident counsel and the things that they're griping about and all of these things.
Fun.
For us in the long-term care field, it's
so relatable.
Apparently very relatable. And so this is just what I've heard from coworkers today. But that's like on my new agenda is to check that out.
That's hilarious.
Because
I love that.
It's a good laugh. I could use a good laugh. So
can't we all? Absolutely. Let's freaking go, man. Absolutely.
Let's do it. Especially before we get into this heavy topic today.
Ooh. Yeah. So this was another one that was suggested by some of you on Instagram. So thank you so much for sending this along. And I just threw it right in Devin's face.
Yep.
For the record, she asked me to throw it in her face.
I did. I knew that I was going to do a Devinism, but I was like, hey, Kate, you see all our stuff. I'm like, just tell me what people have been throwing at us. Give me.
Yep.
And I said, give me choices. I did not get choices. She said, do this guy. She
said,
do
no
this
choice.
Guy. We get a lot of requests and I know nothing. So,
yep. I gave her no choice.
Kate's going to sit back, relax and listen to my voice for an hour.
This is my favorite part of doing the podcast.
Sit back and relax.
Yep.
So we are going to talk about Dr. Randeep Mann. Definitely takes a turn that you don't expect. It kind of comes out of left field, but it's definitely a heavy topic, one that I don't know as if we've focused on so much, which is substance abuse and the substance abuse with patients. I mean, I don't feel like we've had a full, like that's come out in a lot of our shows, but I don't think we've had a full episode on that topic.
Oh, good. Yeah.
But yeah, so
that's surprising, actually, now that you mentioned that we haven't, because it's just like something that is so rampant
because
and
a lot
such
of the
huge reality for all of us.
Well, I mean, as someone who has lost a family member to substance abuse, right? Like some of this that just hit really hard. So,
wow.
But this also gave me some questions to ask you when we get there that we've never asked before. So it was a nice, interesting little like take that I'm like, I wonder like what this, you know, I mean, what the right thing to do is versus what he did.
Wow. Okay.
Anyway, so I don't have a ton about his early life, early careers. I have a little bit, but so he became a physician in the 1980s and he grew up in India. And I think that's part of why I don't have a lot of information is he immigrated here, but so he went to the Armed Forces Medical College in Pune, India, and he became a physician in the 1980s. He married his wife there before they came to the United States. His wife is named Sangeeta. We also call her Sue later on in the episode. Man, and they got married in 1983. So it was after he was a physician, got married, that they came to the States.
So a colleague of mine once told me about medical school in India and the Middle East in general, because they have as competitive as it is in the United States, it's like a million times more competitive out there, I guess. Mm-hmm. And wow. I was not aware of this, but apparently, like, you take this like admission exam, sort of like the MCATs, except for it's way more intense. And please, if any of you out there are listening and I'm not saying it right, please feel free to shoot me a message and correct me. But you take this exam in order to just be considered to apply. And it's like on any given year, there will be like 15 or 20,000 people taking this exam, but there's only going to be like the people that score the highest, the top 300 scores or some odd 300 scores are the only ones going to medical school that year. And if you don't score in like the top 300, then you just have to like wait till the following year to retest and see if you can do well enough to get in. It's like crazy.
I would never get in. I hate standardized tests.
Same.
I would never get in.
Yep. I'd be doing something else.
Give me a practical test on something that like I've studied my ass off for and whatever, but you give me a standardized test, forget it.
Yep. I will mop the medical school. Hand me the mop and I will clean that place. I will clean it up. I'll be a really good janitor.
So when they came to the United States, he did have a number of internships, did a couple of different internal medicine roles at a few, at like one particularly was Johns Hopkins.
Oh, wow.
But it also included MedStar Good Samaritan Hospital, which is also in Baltimore, the same city as Johns Hopkins. So he had done, before going into where we're going to talk about, he did have some, when he came here, some prestigious role, not prestigious, but like had been to prestigious hospitals.
Yeah.
And was a practicing physician and had done some of his internships as well. Him and his wife relocated to Memphis, Tennessee in 1992, away from the Baltimore area. Here, he was doing a lot of emergency room medicine, and he was practicing as an ER physician. That was only for a few years. He ended up having a motorcycle crash accident in 1998. And so that left him like physically incapable of doing like long ER shifts. Like he could still practice medicine, but the rigmarole of
the physical piece of a
Memphis ER was too much for him. Like the standing for a long period of time and some of the physical capabilities, he was having a little bit too much pain. So that ended his career as an emergency room physician. And he had always had the vision of wanting to do a private practice. So that's when he had relocated to Arkansas.
Okay.
And so that's where the rest of this will take place. So that's kind of like the basic history. But so he had opened up a private practice for chronic pain management. And part of me is I'm like, this is great. You know, you just went through an ordeal yourself, right? So you understand, you know, chronic pain, things that affect your life, you know, so you're wanting to help others, right? Now he's doing this in a town called Russellville, Arkansas, and it's pretty small. It's only about like 8 to 10 square miles. So it's a pretty small southern town. And so he had started to grow a decent patient load. You know, at this point, it's the late 90s, early 2000s. Everyone's starting to learn about this doctor who's got his own practice and is like, he's getting referral after referral. People are coming to him to manage their chronic pain. They're hearing really good results. It was so much so that there's like he had worked almost 7 days a week because his patient load was so high for a while when he was really getting up there. And then some of the people around town were also stating that, like, you know, it could be seen like at some point, like he would take walk-ins and whatnot, or he'd be full with his appointments, but there would also be like a line out the door.
Wow.
So,
okay.
You know, this is also
he's doing
almost
great.
This is almost 30 years ago, so it was, like, different. Like, maybe you could walk in during this time, like, I'll see you or whatever. You know, it was a mixture, but...
And that's, like, an interesting philosophy to have for, like, as, like, a pain medicine, like, like, a chronic pain specialist, right?
Right,
because
exactly.
That's, you know, not necessarily a super, like, acute, you know, but I'm sure there are moments where it's, like, very, very acute level of care, but a lot of it is chronic.
It's chronic pain management, trying to work, find what works. And obviously, it's a very tough field now, decades later. That's part of what we're going to get into when we kind of talk about some of this a little bit. But so we're going to talk about two of his patients that he had had during his few years of this private practice. So the first patient that we're going to talk about is Ellie Leanna Harris. So she was a young girl that came from a very loving family and was like the prized possession of her family. She was very beloved and devoted upon. Aww. She was raised in a very loving and warm Southern household. Her mother describes her as being very jovial and had a vibrant personality that just like left a mark with everybody that they saw, that came across from her. She was very light-spirited, happy, and just a lot of people connected with her. Throughout school, she was an impressive athlete. She was very athletic. She was also a gifted artist. And so she just really kind of stood out and she was looking like she was going to have a bright future ahead of her.
She sounds like I want to hang out with her. And she was fucking dope as fuck. Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
Now, like many of us as we're teenagers, sometimes we take a turn in high school. You know, high school is a very trying time. Some people
we
go down some
around and
roads.
We find out. Yes.
We sure find out. However, unfortunately for Ellie and her family, they started to know that this daughter that they had of hers, you know, at one point was full of hope and positivity, started to really be kept away from her loved ones. She started to become distant, a little bit more reserved, a little bit more quiet. They started to get concerned for her when they were noticing the change of demeanor, you know, because it's almost like it wasn't like a switch, but it was just over time. She just became more and more withdrawn. And this was quite a significant turn from her, for her, you know. And so it was really hard to go unnoticed that during the school year, she's going from you were so vibrant to now you hardly talk to us. What's going on, you know?
Wow. Yeah.
Her mother took this really hard, and she took it even harder when she had discovered from a few relatives had come up to her mother, Teresa, which no pun intended, her mother's name is Teresa.
Oh, wow.
But, yeah. So when they had come to her, a few relatives had come to her saying that Ellie had confided with them that she had been experimenting with a few different types of drugs, but it also included heroin.
Oh, God. Oh, that's
so
awful.
Obviously, for a mother, I don't have teenagers yet. All of that terrifies me, what the world is. Like, I can't imagine the reaction that you have, right? And, you know, and how terrifying it is to just hear that news about your child. So upon hearing this news, Teresa and a few other family members decide to do an intervention with Ellie, right? Because what else do you think you're going to do? You hear about
what
this.
What else do you do?
Right. Yeah. You hear about this and you just want to give all your love you can to this person and try to help them. You know. However, at this point in time, Ellie wasn't ready to hear it. You know, she kept on using. Nothing really was working. But fortunately, at a point in time, Ellie did kind of have like a little come to Jesus, I guess we could say. Like, so right around the time when she turned 18, maybe she's like, wow, I'm turning into an adult. This is not what I need to be doing with my life. Mm-hmm. So she did work with her family and get checked into a rehab center. So it's like,
good
sweet, there's some light, right? Like, okay. So she goes and gets checked into a rehab. During her time there, it's reported that she had shown so much resilience to overcome her addiction. It looked really promising. She was really a go-getter and just like ready to do this.
Super motivated and wanted to make a change. Good for
her. So she was there for a few weeks and she was able to go home with Justin a few weeks. She didn't need to be there for months. Again, it was her first time. This was a couple decades ago. So again, I don't know what the average time a person should be in rehab. I think it's different for everybody.
I think it's probably very case by case.
Correct. But so she was there for a few weeks and then was released and went back home. And for a while, it was great. Everything was going fine. She was showing progress. Her loved ones were feeling like they were getting a little bit of the old Ellie back, and they thought that she was on track to full recovery. Unfortunately, in November of 2000, Ellie had injured her back after slipping on ice.
No, I see where this is going.
Yes. So she's having a lot of pain, obviously, from her injury. She would try to take over-the-counter medications to alleviate it. But of course, when that didn't work, she's trying to seek professional help. So she goes to see Dr. Mann. Why not? Yes. You hear about a chronic pain specialist in the area. You want to go there.
Yep.
And to her defense, thankfully, it's, as I'm sure she was, and you kind of see this, you know, and I don't want to say social medias, but a lot of shows like bring to light like someone who's addicted, doesn't want to take any narcotics, right? Because they're afraid.
Right.
So just like this, Ellie was very transparent with him about her past struggle with addiction and how she was worried about that, how she wanted help, but she was worried. And so Ellie and her mother, Teresa, were also, they were content. They felt like he would treat her going overboard, right? They felt like she was going to get the help that she needed to be pain-free, but also not become addicted. Dr. Mann had also assured her that he would treat her pain without letting the medications interfere with her recovery. So he's like, it's okay. There's things that we can do, you know. And he was really like, it's all right. I've got you. So that was in about November of 2000. Shortly after that, Ellie had been going to him for about 14 months. And unfortunately, end of January 2002, Ellie died of an overdose.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, that's awful.
So according to the toxicology report after her death, there was a deadly dose of narcotic medication that was in her system. Now, again, we know her history. Nothing right now was like super like this doctor, right? It's one of the numbers of people that were causing questions. I don't have the exact list of her meds that she was on, but obviously it was a super high number. The thing that really struck me with this was the response that Dr. Randeep had given to Teresa, Ellie's mother. So following the tragedy, Teresa goes to Dr. Randeep Mann to talk about her overdose and to just kind of talk about what happened and her treatment and things like that. And his response to her was, when he was confronted about the overdose, his response to her was, "I have no control over my patients. When they leave, they can do anything they want to with their medication." Now, this was despite knowing her. This was obviously he makes this statement, even though he knew about her history of addiction.
Right.
And that he had. And so actually, I do know some of the medications. Some of the medications that she was prescribed was hydrocodone and alprazolam, which was Xanax.
Oh, yeah.
So
alprazolam. Yeah.
Now, obviously, those two meds led to an opioid addiction. And then this led to her death. Obviously, with each, you know, with an addiction, the doses keep getting higher and higher, which her mother had seen old bottles and she would see that doses were getting higher and higher, refilled too quickly.
Okay.
And she was kind of keeping track of what the number of the bottles would say with the dates, and it was very quick.
So even though you know, she was in recovery, she had said specifically, "I don't, you know, I want to be really cautious about this plan." The doses are still escalating. She's being prescribed like a ton of it. Basically?
Yeah. And so my question to you was also, so part of her toxicology report had hydrocodone, which, again, makes sense with the pain and whatnot. But how about the Xanax? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I mean, so, yeah, he could very well have prescribed it to her if he felt like, you know, anxiety was contributing to her pain and that it might help to alleviate some of that. And also benzodiazepines like alprazolam are often prescribed for muscle spasms. Sometimes if things like Robaxin or cyclobenzaprine, which are like our traditional antispasmodics that we can take for muscle spasms, aren't effective, then the next step would be to move to a benzo.
Okay.
Something like more long acting. So that does make sense, especially for back discomfort.
And so for the benzo for me was the one that was in the question, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, especially knowing, like, fine, you might have to go to an opioid narcotic like hydrocodone for back pain.
Sure.
You know, it's definitely probably one of the milder ones, I would think. Probably. I mean, who knows? You know, it's the hydrocodone, you know, definitely for sure. But I'm just thinking when along the line, but I was surprised by the Xanax. I was just, especially given the drug addiction history, I was just,
sure.
It just,
yeah,
that
it's
one,
interesting.
That
and I'm hoping
me.
That he had maybe like tried something else and she had failed it first. I would sincerely hope that he had at least gone through the proper channels of prescribing her something that is not a benzo before going that route. But yeah, it is something that is prescribed for spasms. So it does make sense to an extent.
And when I get done talking about this other patient briefly, I want to circle back to his comment about, you know, I have no control with what they do with their meds after I prescribe them the medication. I want to talk about this other patient first, and then we'll kind of like circle back on that comment. But so that was in 2002. There was also in some of the following months, another patient named Shelley Green. So initially, Shelley Green, she had almost lost her life due to an overdose in May of 2002. So this, I don't really have the history that led up to that first one, but in May of 2002, she had overdosed, but she had was able to recover. But however, later, there was some claims that and also some findings from her family that some of the prescription medication that was found in the home was in the name of her sister. It was had her sister's name on it in the pill bottle.
Okay.
Yes. Some of the other things that kind of came about with this one was that really kind of dark secrets that came out potentially about him. Not so much more about the overprescribing, but also some of the mechanisms that he would allow people to get for it, basically in exchange for getting medications. And this is,
oh.
yes. So okay. this is where some potential dark secrets came about where it was maybe that he was, where this patient had claimed that he used to give her pills from his private stash in exchange for sex. So,
oh, that is such gross fucking behavior. Genuine. Yes. Like, so, what?
There's a little bit that, like, this one's a little choppy because, like, she would make claims to investigators and whatnot, but she wasn't willing to put anything on the record. She was asked to wear a wire, but she didn't want to say anything against him because it was almost like, yeah, okay, he's the reason, but he's my dealer. Like, I don't know. He's a nice guy. I don't want to, you know what I mean? Like,
him would be cutting off my supply. So there's that.
Yes. But when they were digging deeper, it did look that with the investigators realizing that there had been more patients that had been trading sex for drugs and that were also falling victim to overdoses.
So it was confirmed that he was, in fact, doing that with
there was a lot of reports from a lot more patients. There was a lot more patients with reports.
Not cool.
It's important to note that I want to mention also that Shelley's sister, Holly, also went and saw Dr. Van Diep. So she had suffered for years with, and I think that's how, like, she got some of the pill bottles with the sister's name on it as well.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Maybe giving Shelley some of the scripts as well. Like, he had her information to be able to do that. But Shelley had suffered for a few years from fibromyalgia. And she had dealt with a lot of chronic pain. So she had gone to see him and she describes that, you know, she had also had fears about worrying about being addicted to the drugs. And she did become addicted. She did become addicted and she really felt like it wasn't managed great. Every time it would kind of like wear off, it was just up the dose, up the dose, up the dose. But there was never a stop point to it.
Yeah, that's not how that works.
Correct. So she kind of recalls over the few years that she saw him, you know, they might have started out to Percocet, then moved on to methadone, then moved on to morphine. So she's like, I'm starting to get hit with really heavy drugs. I don't like how this makes me feel.
Yep.
She was definitely addicted, but she was able to kind of overcome that and stop seeing him and kind of work through some other chronic pain measures so that she's not keep going and addicting to the drugs. But she was definitely like alarmed, especially after her sister's overdose and whatnot, like where her path was going. Yeah.
Well, good for her for really. I mean, that's no easy feat, especially if you've got a doctor that's really not motivated to get you off of it when you're like making that decision independently and being like, no, wait, this is wrong. This is going in the wrong direction.
And I think it kind of yourself. And I think it probably really scared her seeing her sister's overdose. Like feeling it as well, but seeing her overdose. And then also like you probably start to doubt your relationship with your physician if you're seeing prescription bottles in your sister's home with your name on it.
Yeah. Like, why am I doing this? What am I doing? Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Ugh. Wow.
So there have also been like a few other reports that when I was just kind of researching now, some people are like, hey, you know, the media is trying to make this man sound like he's a monster and whatnot. But he really like I was his patient and he really did a lot of great things for me. I was able to be relieved of my pain. Other people had comments of like, no, my mother saw him and he prescribed drugs to her in my name and I was a minor.
So
I didn't like take him again. This is like, people can write comments or like their own reviews so it's like some, but there are multiple claims to kind of corroborate this.
Wow.
About that's him bonkers. Writing prescriptions and going around the red tape to get people more drugs. That's definitely been out there.
Yep.
With the suspicions of the doctor's practice, the authorities in the region were like, God, these narcotic deaths, these overdoses are starting to climb up really high. Like we're seeing more than what we had ever really seen. Right.
Absolutely.
And he's the chronic pain management in town. Everybody that's overdosing, they're seeing pain.
They're seeing bottles
with their name on it. So at this point in time, they report him to the Arkansas State Medical Board. And so when he goes to see them in October of 2003, he goes to the state medical board and they do vote to suspend his DEA license.
Good.
So those were because of all of the allegations. So he could still practice medicine, but he wasn't able to prescribe any narcotics.
Okay.
But I do think it's important to note also that Shelley Green unfortunately did have a second overdose.
No,
and it was
you're kidding.
It was at this time that with her second overdose, she did pass away.
Shit.
And the medications that were prescribed to her were in her system were Xanax, methadone, Demerol, and Vicodin.
Oh my God. That is such a, to prescribe all of that at once to yes. someone. And so, did she have active prescriptions for all of these? Like, she didn't just like obtain yes. any of this.
And some of the, and the wow. Demerol was also injectable. She had the injectable Demerol that was
oh
in
my
her
God.
System. So, yeah. Now, before I kind of go on real quick, I wanted to ask your opinion. So this is where I was like, you know, we've never had this question.
Mm-hmm.
But so you obviously have like your provider's license and whatnot, but then you have like a DEA number and everything to be able to do that. What are the mm-hmm. stipulations that they have now versus what they might not have had 20 years ago, right?
On yeah.
prescribing pain management and opioids and whatnot.
Right. So the DEA licensure is like what gives you the ability specifically to mm-hmm. prescribe like any schedule medications, like any narcotic medications whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So like without that, you just are not able to prescribe those. And I'm not sure exactly what, you know, how it worked all the way back then. This was a right. long time ago.
We know that there was not a lot of regulations back then. And that's
right.
part
yeah,
of how this happened. We know that.
So different. Yeah, absolutely. So, like, I think that if they were to put restrictions on his DEA licensure, that would have vastly impacted the, you know, ability to prescribe any sort of narcotics. And I wish I knew a little bit more about what the exact restrictions were back then versus, you
yeah,
know,
that's,
what we
that's
have
okay.
in place now.
We pretty much know that back then, like, there wasn't a lot, right?
Right.
We pretty much know
yeah.
that. And that's why we have an opioid epidemic and whatnot. But, mm-hmm. like, what kind of training do providers receive on how to prescribe chronic pain management, when opioids are appropriate, how much is acceptable? And, like,
yeah.
you know, and they have things now, like, where patients have to have contracts, right? Like, if you're getting
yes.
discharged from the hospital with,
yes.
Like, I remember after my C-section, like, they prescribed me, like, 10 oxy or something, and I had to sign a contract about it. You know, I never mm-hmm. picked them up, but like you have to sign all of these things, right?
Absolutely. So, I mean, everybody throughout their training, when they go through medical education, gets a really significant amount of pharmacology in general, and you know, the opioid specific. I feel like we've leaned a lot more into that more recently because of the opioid epidemic in general. So, I'd love to say that the education back then was very robust on the dangers of polypharmacy and overprescribing opioids. And I would love to say that he definitely went and got a board certification in chronic pain management, because that would have required, you know, extra education on top of his medical mm-hmm. education. I think that it's taken a lot more seriously these days. So I wouldn't be surprised if his education back then was not nearly what it would have been mm-hmm. today.
Yeah.
Just because it's so much more rampant now.
I know, you know, for some chronic pain clinics and whatnot, especially for some people that are on higher doses, and I can speak from personal family experience and whatnot, but like when you have someone who is on chronic high dose opioids for chronic pain, there's not only the contracts, right, but there's specifics on the number of pills with the refills and how long
yes.
you're going to get it. But also there's drug testing. Mm-hmm. And they actually, I believe I think one of this time I was like, all right, this does make sense. They want to, when they do the drugs testing at certain intervals, they want to see it in your mm-hmm. urine at a certain level, because it shows that you're not taking too much or too little, like stashing
right.
it. You know what I mean? Like some of those
Absolutely.
Things, like they're expecting a certain level if you're taking it as prescribed kind
yes.
of things. So there's a
yes.
lot of monitoring. So I get like where 20 years ago, he's probably like, I have no control with what they do with the medications after I give them.
Sure.
But it's also like, you were still ethically, morally responsible. Like
sure.
you.
Yeah.
know that your patient is an addict. You know the number and the combination that you're prescribing.
And it should be a red flag. On top of that. It should be a red flag to you that this person is no longer getting relief from this dose and that they're experiencing withdrawal symptoms between doses. And like, that's all red flag stuff. You know, and
correct.
I think that as a result of the opioid epidemic, it really is a shame for chronic pain patients in general, because I think that chronic pain is chronically undertreated now as a result, and prescribers are more wary than ever to prescribe, you know, higher doses of these meds. But the reality is there's a lot of people out there that do genuinely need long-term opioid pain medications.
Absolutely.
And do need dose escalations at, you know, appropriate intervals, but that requires really close monitoring. It requires, you know, contracts, like you said. It requires lab monitoring, and it obviously carries immense amounts of risk. But if it's going to be something that keeps, you know, people functional, then that's what they need. But it's just a shame what has happened to the chronic pain population in the wake of this opioid epidemic and how now it has caused such under-prescribing and people are so nervous about prescribing.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, it's frustrating because, like, I can't even think back to 20 years ago, like, when you and I were in college and I had found the best cough medicine on the planet.
Oh, the good stuff.
I mean, you even told me, you're like, Devin, you did not snore. You slept amazingly. You did not keep me up all night coughing, right? When you get that stuff. And it's like, for the last 20 years, no matter when I've been sick, and I could have something for weeks, right? And you just can't breathe, all this stuff. But it's like, you can't get that shit. You know what I mean?
You can't.
Like,
nope.
You get this stinky little Tessalon Pearl, and it's like, that don't do anything.
Yeah, those don't do shit. They work like half the time for half the population.
It's like, this is what I'm going to get you to say that I did something for you, but you came in for the good stuff and you're not getting it.
Yep, that's just,
you know,
the way it
but
is.
It is the way it is, and if that's what we have to do to keep the rest of our population safe, I mean, you know, to prevent stuff, you know, stuff like this from 20 years ago happening again. So, kind of circling back to him, so he had lost his DEA license. So he's still a practicing physician, but he cannot prescribe narcotics. However, he decided he wanted to take the route of, you're discriminating against me, and he's filing multiple appeals. And so he was stating that he was being discriminated against because of his ethnicity and because he was from India and he wasn't from here.
And the fact that he was having sex with his patients. And,
yeah, that had nothing to do with it. He was discriminated against.
Oh, my God.
So he ended up winning. So he had filed multiple appeals. And in 2004, he ended up winning an appeal. And so he was able to regain his DEA license. And so I want to make mention that during this year where he did not have his DEA license, the overdose deaths in this county where he lived, that was, again, very small, was almost zero. Like, they might have had one in that entire time, but it was next to nothing. The investigator said it averaged 0 to 1 per month. Like, it was so low.
Not a coincidence.
However, it doesn't take long that in 2004 that he was then connected to, in a very short amount of time, 18 overdose deaths.
18? Are you kidding?
18. It was like, he's got his DEA license back. He's back open for business and his patient load is rising again. And so are the deaths.
Ugh.
So that clearly just shows, in my opinion, you know, just the complete lack of understanding, respect. I don't give a shit, you know?
Mm-hmm. Disregard for human life, basically, and human, like a
so
complete.
Again, he's connected to a significant number of overdose deaths, and so he has to go again in front of the medical board in July 2006. So they're keeping a very close watch on this man, right?
As, like, they should.
So he's going back. The medical board in 2006 was headed by Dr. Trent Pierce, and this time he was not only forced to surrender his DEA license, but he was also stripped of his medical license.
Wow.
Right?
Yep.
Thank you, good old Arkansas Medical Board, right? Like, we hear cases all the time where it's just like, why are, you know? So they were keeping a close watch on this dude, and then they're like, you're not getting away with it any longer. So
I'm glad they didn't
everything.
Just, like, let him fall through the cracks. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I wish they were on it a little bit more before 18 more people died of an
obviously,
opioid.
Obviously. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So this is where the plot thickens and kind of takes a turn that's like, where the fuck did this come from?
Okay.
But so I mentioned that Dr. Trent Pierce was the one that was on the head of the medical board that stripped him of his license. So I want to just talk about him for a second. So he was a well-known family practitioner in West Memphis, Arkansas. And he is currently the chairman of the Arkansas Medical Board. Just said that. However, he goes to work one day, February 4th of 2009. So this is a couple years after the stripping of, this is all, not quite 3 years, about 2.5 years
after
the stripping
they took
of his license. Yes.
Okay.
When Dr. Pierce is walking from his house to his car, and next thing you know, a bomb explodes from his car. And
what?
A bomb explodes from his car, and he is heavily injured. He has burns on 18% of his body, 2 broken bones, the loss of a left eye, damage to the right eye, and damage to his hearing.
I can't believe he survived.
I can't believe he survived either. I don't know how close he was to that car, but he was close enough to break 2 bones, lose an eye, have significant burns.
Holy fuck.
So he was badly injured. He was badly, badly injured. So this was like really alarming to the community. Like,
I should fucking hope so. Jesus Christ.
A car bomb in a man's driveway just explodes.
In Memphis, Arkansas.
Correct.
Okay.
And this well-known physician is badly injured.
Like permanently disabled as a result, basically.
Yes. So initially, the police had no immediate leads on this. And so, you know, upon interview, when he's healthy enough to interview and all that stuff, like they don't, again, it's 2009. Probably not a lot of home cameras. You know, there's no ring cameras and all that crap. But thank God for now. However, so when they're interviewing him and he's healthy enough for an interview and whatnot, they are talking to him and they're just like, who would want to harm you? Right? Mm-hmm. Like, who would want to harm you? And they did have a potential lead because Dr. Pierce was a co-defendant in a wrongful death lawsuit with the Arkansas Supreme Court. I don't have a lot of details from it. I do believe it's with a nursing home patient and he was a co-defendant. But, you know, we know that there's malpractice things all the time, even if things aren't intentional. Right.
Oh,
for sure.
Yeah.
So he brought that up that maybe, you know, if someone wanted to harm him, he's like, well, I have this wrongful death lawsuit here and whatnot that, you know, I'm taking part in. But they also asked if over the last few years, if there's been anybody on the medical board in any of those cases.
Right. Yeah.
And he did go back the last few years and he was able to give a list of 5 potential names because they were ones that were completely stripped.
Right.
So like, okay. if anybody, it would be these 5 because when I was the head of overseeing their cases, they were completely stripped of their license. So they're going through their lists of names and Dr. Randeep Mann, you know, does kind of come a little bit alarming to them. Not just again, it's racial bias, right? So they do see that he's of a different ethnicity, not from this country, all of that. Mm-hmm. So there is the whether it's subconscious or conscious racial bias. I do think that was a part of it. But they also saw that when they were pulling all sorts of records, he was on the list for the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearm Agency when that pulled. So like they pulled a lot of background on everybody and whatnot. And so they saw that he has a fair amount of registered firearms. So they're like, well, that sticks out as different from everybody else, right? So they're like,
that's interesting
that they made that connection. Yeah.
Okay.
I guess when you're given suspect names and when you're looking in, you know, when they're just running the background checks and all those things and when you learn about people, right?
Sure.
They just, that
just pops an interesting factoid because you're right. Like somebody with a whole arsenal of guns might just collect guns or they might have other munitions, other things that they like to collect. And
so again, it was just something that stood out to them as they're going through everything. Now, he was questioned by the authorities. He initially gave him an alibi that he was at the gym, but he did allow them at the time to search his property. He's like, yeah, it's fine. You can come look around. I have nothing to hide. And he actually showed off inside his house his collection of firearms, which was massive. Like, it was like According to some of the things that I saw, it said like this was the biggest collection that some of these agencies had ever seen.
Whoa.
Type of collection. Okay. And it did remind me of this one house. When I was growing up, I was a teenager and I went to my friend's parents' house and I'm sitting in the living room and I'm looking around. He was a veteran, but mm-hmm. he had a hobby and mm-hmm. it was there everywhere in the living room.
Wow.
And I remember looking up on a shelf and I'm seeing all these grenades and I'm like, I'm 14. I don't want to be here.
I am 14 and I'm afraid.
And get me out of here. He had to like reinforce the floor in his living room to support the weight of his safe. Like,
seriously?
It was that,
Jesus.
It was that heavy.
Yeah. Hey, man, I got nothing against guns. My husband is an avid hunter.
Of course.
And I've hunted before and we have firearms in the house. Just make sure you lock them up and keep them away from the kiddos because my kids have grown up with their dad hunting and have a very healthy respect for firearms. But it's always when you think they would never go down and check it out and they would never get curious about how it feels and how heavy it is because they do get curious.
That's when those mistakes
happen.
Yep, yeah,
that's
sure.
right. That's right.
So they questioned him on his collection, right? They're just like, you know, you have an exorbitant amount, right?
This is
like,
a lot. Are you ready for the zombie apocalypse or the fuck's going on here?
But he was able to show them permits. You know, they were legally owned. And so it's just like, there's nothing we can go from here, right? It's like, this amount looks suspicious, but, you know, again, there's nothing really we can take off from this.
Right.
So they're kind of hitting a dead end at this point and not really anything comes along. Until about a month later. So about a month after the bomb explosion went off, there was a city worker in the neighborhood. And he just so happened to be working on some water lines and checking leaks and whatnot. And so he's walking along the ground. He's about 900 to 1,000 feet away from Dr. Mann's house. When the worker later testified at the trial that he was king, he was in a clearing in the neighborhood where they were. And then he stepped on something that was buried in the ground. Like it just noticed like it was like hard to him. It sounded like a big like thump when he was working. So he started to pull this object that was nearly covered on the ground. But then he stopped and he's like, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't look at this. But then he's like, you know what? Nope, maybe I should. So now he's like digging up the item. And what he sees is an ammunition canister. And it contained 98... 40 millimeter grenades.
Wait, 98?
98 of them, not 100.
So,
98 of them.
So, I'm picturing, I know nothing about grenades. I'm picturing like, I am picturing like a, what I know as a grenade from the movies in my mind.
You take the little pin.
So, you take the pin out, you fucking throw it, and you walk away all cool and don't react to the explosion behind you while you're walking. Yeah. But like, so this ammunition canister is like fucking huge, right? Like this is huge.
You would think. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And that's part of what gets into in the trial, but yes. So yeah, it's big. And so and that's part of like what alarmed it wasn't buried super deep, right? You know what I mean? So it's like, what is that? Right? Mm-hmm. So they were compatible to, they noticed at this time when it was brought to the police, so that it was compatible. So one of the things that Mann had showed the investigators when he was at the house, when he was showing off his quote unquote collection, was a grenade launcher. And so the type of grenades that were found buried within 900 to 1,000 feet of his house were compatible with the grenade launcher that the investigators had been shown by Dr. Mann. So they're like, okay. So this at least gave them enough to do a search warrant, right? Like, so before, like, he was invited into the house, looked around, so now they could do a search warrant.
That's crazy. Like, I want to know his explanation for why did he say he had fucking buried all of these grenades?
We'll get there.
Okay.
But during a search of the property, so now they're doing, like, a full search, not just, like, hey, talking to you in your living room with all your guns around.
Okay.
I mean, you don't have to do a hard, deep search to find what they found, which was in a bathroom, in the shower, in the bathtub in his bathroom, was a spare tire. And so they're like, why do you have a spare tire in here?
Yes, valid question. I was like, wait.
They collected it because they believed, in theory, he was practicing the setting up of the bomb, how to hide it and everything, because the bomb was in the spare tire of Dr. Trent's
car. Oh, I did not realize that. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so when it went off in the car, the grenade was
in the
spare tire of Dr. Trent's car.
Oh my God. What a turn. This is crazy.
Who the fuck has a tire in their bathroom?
Genuinely. Yeah, well, exactly.
I'll give you the excuse that he gave in a minute.
I'd love to know.
So he was charged at this point in time. He was arrested that day for possessing the unregistered grenades because those were not unregistered. So they're like, well, we're at least going to take you in and get you off the street while we figure out the rest of this.
Fair.
So this is late. So then later, it's several months later, this is in January of 2010. He has another indictment. And so this indictment has a total of 10 charges. Okay. So some of them were also with his wife. His wife was kind of not playing nice in the sandbox with the investigators.
Okay.
So Dr. Mann was charged with 6 counts. One pertained to the use of weapon of mass destruction. One to malicious use of an explosive on a vehicle. 3 to unregistered grenades and firearms. 1 to unlawful possession of a machine gun. And 1 to possession of contraband, which was chloroform, while he was in custody at the prison.
Chloroform, huh?
Chloroform, right?
Gross.
So
don't love his, that.
And then both him and his wife were charged together with 2 counts of obstruction of impedance of justice. And his wife was also charged with making a false declaration to a federal grand jury. Wow. So she just, you know, whether it was an intentional or not, or just stand by your man.
Girl,
she
it's was time like, to, girl, you know? You can do better. I promise you. I mean, he's out there just like fucking all his patients. Yeah. For pain meds and shit. Like, girl, go get yourself a new man. You just go get yourself a new man. Listen, I know that you're from India and your divorce rates are low, but you do not have to go through this shit just to save face.
You're in the U.S.
You're in America now, honey.
It's 50%.
It's fine.
We give you permission.
Yes. You and all your neighbors will be a divorce club, all right? Just suck it up and move on.
We let you file here.
My God.
All right. So during the trial, so then he goes to trial. And now I will say that the prosecute didn't have a lot of forensic evidence. And maybe that's because everything exploded.
Yeah, I mean, but that's...
So a lot of what they had was circumstantial. You and I have covered many court cases, and we can pretty much agree when there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, right?
For sure.
But here's some of the things that they did present. So they were able to present a witness that she worked in the house for Dr. Pierce. Her name is Velma Gale. She was like a housekeeper.
Okay.
And she had worked for them for a long time. Initially, she didn't mention anything, which was a little suspect, but a few months after the explosion, she told agents that she had seen a man jogging in place near the house the night before the explosion. So she's like, I don't know, he was neither black nor white. Maybe he was Iranian. He had a baseball cap on and a long ponytail that was just hanging out. And they're saying that she just initially didn't report it because she was afraid. She's like, look what happened to him. If I told someone, was it going to happen to me? I was a little nervous.
Yeah, okay.
So the next person that was also a witness for the prosecution, so they had some allegations, which was by Stephen Briscoe, and he was the roommate of Dr. Mann in the detention facility. So Stephen Briscoe, so he was awaiting sentencing for felony possession of a firearm. He told the attorneys that while he was jailed, Dr. Mann had offered him $50,000 to kill Dr. Pierce. He stated that he really, quote unquote, really needed this done. And that his quote was because Dan and them didn't do a good job the first time. Now, to Briscoe, they didn't really say who Dan and them were.
Okay.
However, come to find out in my research, Sue and Dr. Randeep Mann had a son named Dan.
Shit.
Surprise.
Oh my God. What is going on in this fucking shit?
So come to find out. However, he was never indicted in any of this. So,
So this is alleged, or whatever.
So, again, right. So, it's alleged. This is what the roommate is stating. He stated in court documents that, so his roommate is stating that because, that Dr. Mann stated because Dan and them didn't do a good job the first time. But Briscoe was like, I don't know who Dan is, right? He's got a son named Dan.
Yikes.
So.
Unbelievable.
Yes. So Briscoe was apparently like really trying to also be a squeaky wheel to help some of his sentencing because did testify against also two other inmates who had made confessions to him while he was in the jail.
Okay.
And so for his testimony in those separate cases, he did have his sentence reduced. However, he's saying for Dr. Mann, he was testifying against him on his own free will and wasn't promised anything in return.
Oh, wow. Okay. So he just did it because he just had
a moment. His quote was, you can call me an informant or a snitch or whatever you want to. I've got a conscience and I've got a heart and I can tell you what he said to me. So he insists that he wasn't getting anything for testifying against Dr. Mann.
I want to know, like, I've watched and listened to a lot of true crime. And, you know, it always gets back to investigators when you blab to your cellmate about what you did.
Mm-hmm.
That should be like rule numero uno. It doesn't matter who you talk to. You're always innocent if you're going to be playing that game.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy.
Yep. Now,
don't do that.
The defense also, you know, clearly stated, you know, they were doing their defense stating that he was innocent and that he was a target due to his race and his love for collecting weapons.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to state that, you know, tests of the canisters and whatnot and the grenade showed no physical link to Dr. Mann that was from the canister at the house. They also tried to examine, like, photographs of the car and whatnot, and they're like, these things don't just make sense. But they're also looking at the hole of the canister that was in the ground.
Okay.
They're also just, like, trying to, like, they're trying to poke holes in the investigation, and they're just saying the size of the hole can't physically fit that many grenades, right? So, like, they're just trying to point things in that direction that this canister wouldn't even fit in the hole that you dug in the ground. But it clearly came from there. So, all right. So the next thing is, this was my favorite. Why was the spare tire in the bathtub?
Yes. Tell me.
And Dr. Mann's like, oh, that's such a simple explanation.
Already.
He had it in the shower because he was trying to wash algae off of it. The spare tire came from his Mazda. His hatchback had leaked. He said he didn't want to clean it outside in the cold weather, so he scrubbed it in one of his seven bathrooms. Doing so seemed unusual.
As one does.
And I'm like,
as one fucking does. Haul their spare tire into their bathtub just to do your monthly algae cleanse.
It's like,
oh my God.
Yeah. I'm like, okay. March in Arkansas can't be that cold. But
can't be that bad. I mean, genuinely. No. My God. That's actually hilarious.
Yeah. I was like, Kate's going to love that one. I got to get my algae off.
Gotta put it in the shower.
Yeah.
Gotta go get its fucking, you know, shampoo and condition on.
So.
Gotta give it an everything shower.
They also tried to poke holes in the statement from the housekeeper about seeing a jogger the night before the blast. They're trying to say that it was Dr. Mann's accomplice, potentially the son. They stated in the closing statement that the identity of that person, you know, it's fuzzy and it's murky. There's two problems with her statement. One is it just raised ethnicity, and frankly, that's offensive. So again, they were really pushing back on the discriminatory stuff that had worked previously in 2004 when he was able to get his license back. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
His attorneys also argued in the grenades that he had that were sold to him. So the grenades that Dr. Mann had actually had were not the type that were used in the bombing. And they said, even assuming it was speculation to conclude they were trying to talk to the person, one of the witnesses that they had, this is what it was this person with the last name of Han. This was the guy who sold the grenades to Dr. Mann. So they were trying to link the fact again that they were sold to him and they were used in. So he had sold him 8 devices for as long as 15 years before the bombing. And so they were also saying, like, you know, you've been selling to him for years. None of them have ever been used. You know, so again, it's just trying to do so much speculation. So they're trying to just poke holes in all of the stuff.
Yes. Try to
doing what defense attorney.
Things.
Yeah. So they also wanted to point that he had kept all these grenades in his possession for over a decade. And they had only found, like, they're saying, oh, and this is the only one that you have ever found that was of this type. That's just like the one in the car. And they don't know where the other seven are. So I don't know if they're plotted somewhere in the ground or what, but.
It's a mystery.
Dr. Pierce did appear in front of the court. So he did make his own testimony, which was obviously very effective considering how banged up and damaged and he was heavily injured. And essentially on August 9th, 2010, he was convicted of conspiracy to carry out the bombing. His wife was also convicted of conspiring to conceal the evidence. So she was full on committed.
Oh, my God.
Now, thankfully, in February of 2011 was his sentencing, and he was sentenced to life in prison and 360 months. So that's like, what, 30 years for two bombing counts, 10 years for three weapon counts, and 5 years for obstruction counts, and had to pay $100,000 in restitution.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes. Now, his legal team obviously was trying to do a bunch of appeals. So they're appealing. And finally, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals in 2012, they upheld his convictions, but they did feel like they needed to resentence some of his accounts. They said, however, they ruled that he should be resentenced on all accounts except for the obstruction accounts due to errors during his previous sentencing. His conviction for two counts of the illegal possession of a firearm was also ordered to be dropped. So they had dropped some stuff, but then they resentenced and it actually turned out to be more in the ending of the sentencing. He was already getting life in prison anyway. So he was sentenced to life in prison in 30 years on bombing and two charges, but they upped some of the years and some of the weapon charges. But again, he's life in prison regardless.
Right.
There was really not much that changed. I love when they're just like, oh, well, we actually increased it because he got 10 more years of whatever. But again, it's also already life.
Yeah, it's already like, well, he's not going anywhere. I mean, I get wanting justice for all of the things that he did and like wanting it on the record. I do get that. Mm-hmm. And I respect that for sure.
So Dr. Mann maintains his innocence. And he said that life in prison is like being in a nursing home. There are running tracks, indoor and outdoor basketball courts, and ping pong and pool tables. I don't know what kind of nursing home has that.
I want to know what fucking nursing home he's in.
It does sound good, but not, his quote is, it does sound good, but not utopia by far.
Administrator, can we get a basketball court, indoor and outdoor, please? And also
ping pong
tables, ping pong. That all sounds great. Sounds great. Yeah.
Yeah. So during a while in prison, he also taught GED classes to inmates, but he has stopped doing that. And since because of his back pain, he just sits in his unit watching TV, doing legal work and reading books.
His routine back pain, huh?
Yeah. As I quote, the routine here is one of boredom. It is my destiny. I can handle it. More people have suffered greater. I will not quit fighting this ordeal.
Mm-hmm.
He was never charged in any of the overdose deaths. If it wasn't for this interesting turn of the bombing against Dr. Pierce, he would probably be a free man.
Yep, you're absolutely right. He'd just be out there doing
and
whatever.
That is the conclusion.
That is so
Dr.
crazy.
And Randy Mann.
Like you said, the fucking turn it takes is like so unexpected.
Yeah, I know, because now we're talking about this really tough subject of overdose deaths, his misappropriation of the drugs.
Yeah, and now it's like bombs, grenades?
Like, yes.
What? Yep. That was a really crazy case.
Isn't that weird? Isn't that crazy? Mm-hmm. Like, it just takes a really weird turn. Obviously, they were saying that his motive was because, you know, he had been stripped of his livelihood by this provider. You know, he was the head of the chair that did all that and stuff. But
yeah.
You know, I think if you look like a rat, smell like a rat, you're trading sex for drugs
probably
and all the way.
A rat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some people, man, it's fucking crazy what some people will do just out of like hunger for money and power and greatness. It's just fucking never ceases to amaze me.
Mm-hmm.
These people are awful.
Yeah.
Thank you, Devin. That was a great
story. You're welcome. You were welcome. Yeah. It definitely had some turns that you're like, what?
Wait, it was so, oh, that slapped me right in the face, that whole car bomb situation, I'll tell you. Jeez, yeah. I'm pro.
So, if you want to keep listening to us, everyone, you can check us out on Facebook at Med Crimes Podcast.
You can find us on YouTube by searching Med Crimes Podcast.
You can check us out on Instagram at Med Crimes Podcast.
If you wish to become a Patreon, you can find us at www.patreon.com/medcrimespodcast. And if you forgot the link to Comfort that we mentioned at the beginning of the episode, it's comfrt.com/medcrimes. You can get 15% off your purchase.
If you want to send us any crazy stories, ideas, suggestions, we clearly use them. Yes. So you can contact us at medcrimes@gmail.com.
Stay safe. Don't sleep with your doctor for pain medicine.
Don't do it.
Go to a board-certified chronic pain specialist if you have chronic pain.
If you have chronic pain, I'm sorry, because that's just terrible.
That's a drag. Just keep advocating for yourself and find the right provider. You know, there are providers that are educated enough and confident enough to prescribe without shaming you. It's out there. Help is out there.
Stay safe out there, folks. Toodaloo.
We love you.